You can? How about that?
Better.
Sorry. I should say I have been super sick. My voice is gone. But nothing contagious, by the way. Don't worry about that. So I'll give you my best. Truth of the divine, according to Plato. Thank you so much, everybody, especially to call. And don't worry too much about the slides. These are really for me to keep track of my argument, right? And by the way, if you cannot hear me, just raise your hand and I'll try to do my best. So this is all right. By the way, these are some of the slides that are recycled from some of my classes. And so they have images that 18-year-olds like. Blinking, things like that. The key idea, by the way, this is for the Platonists in the room. It should say inspired by Plato. It's not really analysis, very close analysis of Plato. So here's our guy. And this is, all right. Key idea, things are not what they seem. So for example, this thing, I think it's called a lectern or something like that, right? Seems solid and still. But things are not what they seem. This is seems solid, but as you know, is a bunch of atoms. And this is the iconic representation of the atom. The iconic is completely off. There are many reasons for that. But one of the reasons is that if you take an atom from this thing and enlarge it, so that it's about this size, so the nucleus of the atom is about this size, the size of a melon, right? Then the next electron would not be here. And it would still be too small, it would be completely invisible to the naked eye, of course. So you would not see this electron circling around. But it would not be here either. At this scale, the next atom would be miles away, 4 miles away. So what you would have is a little speck buzzing around this melon, a little speck 4 miles away, and between the speck and the melon, there's nothing else at all. Atoms are mostly empty space. In fact, the ratio of matter to space is 1 to 100,000. So atoms are mostly empty space. This thing is made of atoms. So therefore it follows that this thing is mostly empty space. So it seems solid, but with Plato, things are not what they seem. And obviously the point is not about this lectern, the point is about reality in general. It's also not still. It's buzzing with movement, of course, the atoms are buzzing with movement. It's rotating around the Earth, and so on and so forth. Nothing, no known object is still. The only thing closer to stillness is the very middle of a black hole. The very middle point, it's called point of singularity for whatever reason. But that's the closest thing to stillness. This is not still, it seems still only. So in a sense, this thing could be seen as this. A lot of empty space, broken from time to time by these buzzing little things called atoms. And by the way, this is not a computer model of anything. This is just PowerPoints, right, and GIFs stolen from the internet. So in fact, it would not look like that at all. It would really, this is too crowded. Right, and so it would be really a lot of empty space. And in fact, this applies to the projector, to the chair, to you as well. And so we, you and I, are also mostly empty space, turns out. The only difference is that there's a physicist whose name is Bohr, who described human beings is a swarm, right? Like a swarm of flies, for example, a swarm. But the only difference between this swarm and this one is that this swarm of atoms is conscious of its existence. Anyways, things are not what they seem. And interestingly, because we're mostly in space, a lot of things go through us. The H's are little, smaller than an atom, subatomic. And if they are little, they go through us. And people in the United States, everything is measured, right? So people have measured just how many things go through us. So for example, if you take something the size of your eye, it's about a square inch, and you try to figure out how many little things called neutrinos, tiny, crazy little things called neutrinos, just how many of them go through your eye. The number is pretty surprising, actually. So it would be 60 billion neutrinos per second per square inch. All right? And neutrinos, by the way, the Nobel Prize in 2018, if I remember correctly, went to the guy who discovered that neutrinos have mass. So they are actually little things, and they go through us. So quintillions, sextillions of these things go through us every second, through us. Again, things are now what they seem. The idea, in fact, in Plato is that reality is often radically different from what it seems. So reality seems understandable, normal, but only from afar. As you get closer to reality, reality becomes very confusing. And if you get really close to reality, reality seems utterly absurd and crazy. So it cannot be really grasped intuitively. More about that in a second. Consider, for example, this moving little things. These things are gifts from CERN, the laboratory that is studying very small things, particles. And they represent the tiniest things that we know of. They're called quantum particles. So the tiniest scale of the world. And when you look at those things, they do crazy things. So for example, one of those quantum things can be in two places at once. They can be localized and delocalized at the same time. So it would be like you having this perspective and the second floor perspective at the same time, which seems crazy, right? Which is impossible, illogical. But the idea derived from Plato is the reality out there is under no obligation whatsoever to cater to our beliefs about it. Reality out there is under no obligation to seem fine or normal. And the closer you get, the more not normal it becomes. These are also from the world of the very tiny to the world of the very big, right? This is the astronomical scale. As you can see here, maybe. Okay, everybody can see this. These things are two black holes about to collide. It's a computer model. So if you think about what a black hole is, it's also very insane, very, very strange. So a black hole, in short, long story short, is really something that has a lot of mass. Think about something that is super, super massive, but has zero volume. Now how about that for crazy? Okay? And what happens is that these things, they essentially are trapped by gravity, and gravity does what it does. Namely, it sucks everything towards the middle point. So the thing becomes smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller, and past a certain point of no return, but there's no other force stopping the collapse. Then the thing continues to collapse until it loses its volume, but not its mass. So there are things out there that are enormous, extremely forceful gravitationally, but have no volume. And in fact, so this is not really these things are not really the black holes. They are just kind of a big circle around them. That's called the event horizon. That doesn't let light stay. But the actual thing, the black hole, is a minuscule, invisible, volumeless, massive object. What about that for braces? And we can say, you know, but our scale, we have a good grasp of that. But it's not true either, because as Plato argues, our senses suck essentially. Our senses are completely flimsy. You're almost deaf in comparison to the dog. Your hearing goes from 20 hertz, very low, to 20,000 hertz, very high. But your dog goes all the way to 60,000. And a bat goes all the way to 100,000. So we're all really kind of missing a lot of the sound. But also visually, right, we can detect only 1/10 of a trillionth of the electromagnetic spectrum. So that it's not like the rest of the stuff is invisible. It's just that we don't see it because our eyes are very, very flimsy. So it's impossible, therefore, to have a good understanding of reality with your senses. If you look around, you have the sense that, I can see everything the way it is. Plato says it's an illusion. Reality, by the senses, is an illusion for Plato. This is an example that my students like. Oh, not this one, the next one. Plato argues also that your senses are constantly not only limiting your understanding, but deceiving you about the nature of reality. That's one of the functions of your eyes, for example. They're really tricky about how nature works or what it is. So, for example, consider bioluminescence. As you know, bioluminescence is the capacity of living organisms to emit their own light, right? And so if I ask you a stupid question, are you bioluminescent? The answer would be, we're not, generally speaking, unless the gentleman says yes. You would be completely correct, of course, because we emit infrared and we're blind to it. But a snake out there spots us in the middle of the night. It's dead dark out there, and as far as the snake is concerned, we're like the fireflies glowing around. That's why the snake can catch the right away. We wonder how, if you cannot see anything. Well, the snake sees the bioluminescence of the rat as well as ours. So, this is the idea. The idea is you are bioluminescent, but we're blind, poetically actually, to our own bioluminescence, to our own light, essentially. And this is one of the nice things about Plato. It helps us understand just how blind we are, not only about the world out there, but how blind we are to ourselves as well, about ourselves. I think we have time. This was a maybe if we have time kind of slide. Perfect. So consider color, for instance. This is also kind of bizarre. So you see blue, and you think there's blue out there. But what happens is it turns out that what is happening is that this surface that you call blue bounces off some photons. Absorbs and others. And those that hit your retina from that surface, essentially what they do is they activate these little things inside your retina called the rods and cones, and then they send a certain signals to you at the back of your head, the visual cortex. And in the back of your head, there's a little electrical storm. And you experience that as blue. But right? The photons themselves have no color. They only have three little properties. Zero mass, zero charge, and the velocity of the light, 168,000 miles per second. But none of the formal properties, blue, orangey, whitish, that's not a formal property of any of those things. And what that means is that the roadmaps that we color code are actually not color coded. And what that means is that there's no such a thing as blue in the world. There's no such a thing as orange, right? Or sweetness, for example. You know, I grab my cup of coffee and I like it nice and sweet. And I think, oh, the coffee is sweet. But in fact, if I had the system of a lion, for example, it would never occur to me to call it sweet because I would not have the sensors to detect this kind of molecule in that particular way. And in fact, if your eyes would be a little bit different, human eyes would be different, it would never occur to us that there's blue out there. For example, if your eyes would have the retina of a deer, for example, it would never occur to you to say, oh, there are orange things. The apple is orange. It would not be a thing, right? So color is not a fact about the world, but it is an interpretation. It's not a fact about reality, it's a fact about human consciousness. And this is the nice thing about Plato. It makes this important distinction. Human consciousness appears to be a reflection of reality, but that is an illusion. Anyways. More nuances. Here's another slide that I show to my students sometimes. So the idea here is that if you look at the world with your eyes, with a naked eye, you will not have any true, real understanding of the nature of reality. But good news is that we can look at the world with the mind's eye, that is to say, through the filter of knowledge. And for Plato, that is the only way of actually getting a glimpse of reality. And so we are blind with respect to an eagle, for example. An eagle can spot a rabbit 3 miles away, but you try to spot a rabbit 3 miles away, the best you can do is spot a house, maybe, the features of a house. So we're pretty blind with respect to an eagle. But if we develop knowledge, for example, of physics, the eagle is dead blind with respect to us because we can see the atoms, the eagle cannot. Right, so this is a super sense, essentially knowledge is a super sense, a super sixth sense that compensates essentially for the flimsiness of our sensorium. All right, so this is a kind of summary of what we've been talking about. So the idea for Plato is that there is the world that we see, and then there is another world hidden by it. There is reality, or Plato called the appearance of reality, and then beyond that, there is the actual reality, okay? And about truth, the idea is that there is the appearance of truth, and then the reality of truth, that are two very different things. All right, so we're getting close to the punchline, and we have Plato. Oh, yeah, nice. So, here's where we get closer to the notion of the divine. And this is one idea that a lot of my students, especially who are believers, love. With all humility and respect, I'm not a believer, but my students really love this idea. So, here's what Plato says. That there is a world out there that is hidden to the naked eye. He calls it, by the way, presence. Right? He's kind of grasping for words, he's inventing a new language. He calls it presence. This is the hidden world beyond the senses. And he says that this world is governed by a certain set of principles. And today, more than 2,000 years later, we call it, for example, the laws of physics, right? The law of motion, the law of gravity, the law of thermodynamics, and so on. In other words, this thing encloses a set of principles, some logic. If it didn't, it wouldn't exist, right? If there were no principles in reality like that, we wouldn't have physics, which is the study precisely of the principles, the logic that governs reality. So here is the idea. There's this hidden world, and it encloses a certain logic, which is, I think, fairly easy to agree with because we have physics. Pleasure, pleasure, pleasure. And so what Plato says is that this logic that governs reality implies, right, reasonably enough, an intelligence. And so Plato is saying that reality has not only a logic, but also an intelligence. Everything, an intelligence that Plato says essentially sweeps like a breath throughout reality, creating reality. We call it the laws of physics, etc. But for Plato, it's an intelligence that is really responsible for what we are, for what this thing is, for what the universe is. It's a logic that expresses itself. It's an intelligence that expresses itself in the world that we can see. Right? So, finally, the next idea here is Plato calls this intelligence of reality itself the cosmic soul. So what he means by that is that really reality itself, is ensouled. So you look at the trees out there, the stars out there, that is the domain of a sweeping breath and intelligence, a soul. Plato calls it the cosmic soul. And so knowledge is what gives you essentially a glimpse into that cosmic soul. So it's only by developing knowledge that you can have any hope of having a glimpse of this universal soul. Not a matter of faith for Plato, not a matter of belief. On the contrary, it really is a matter of knowledge. And this is the first time that I know of in human history where there is a demonstration of a universal spirit that is a logical demonstration. There is no request for faith, there's no request for belief or anything like that. The only request is really you have to think very, very, very hard. And then you will follow that you will have a glimpse into this universal spirit. Finally, and this is going to be, I know I've been saying that like for a few times. All right. So for Plato, this is what he's talking about is about a universal intelligence that is vast, that for Plato is glorious, glorious intelligence out there, that is eternal, right? Because we all die. This thing will be destroyed, the world will die like everything else, but still, even then, right, the laws of physics, the principles that govern reality will still be governing reality. So it transcends us, it's transcendental in that way, it transcends the normal decay of the visible world. It outlasts the normal decay of the visible world. So there's the divine animal. And this is really where I think the Christian idea of a universal mind comes to the fore. So the way I know it, in the third century, a guy from Africa, Augustine, and by the way, I've heard Augustine and Augustine, so I'm not sure what it is. So Augustine reads Plato, and he says, Plato is talking about God, right? And incorporates his notion of a universal intelligence into the Christian tradition. It's the first time. And then it remains that today people think of divinity as a universal intelligence. This is, in fact, not biblical. It is Plato's gift to Christianity. It's called that. Plato's gift to Christianity. So, you're welcome. All right. For Plato, there's a difference, really. Because for Augustine, this universal mind is a person, essentially. So it's universal, it's eternal, it's glorious, and you can communicate with that. You can ask for victory in war, you can ask for cure for diseases, and so on. But for Plato, it's different. For Plato, this is glorious, eternal, sublime, universal intelligence, but it's utterly indifferent to us. It's just there. To try to communicate with that, it would be like trying to communicate with mathematics. You can understand the language of mathematics and the messages of mathematics, but you cannot communicate with mathematics. You can decode it, and Plato tried to decode, well, not Plato said it, but Platonic people try to decode this universal mind. But nobody hoped to actually be able to communicate with that. And the difference is that in the Christian tradition, this universal mind becomes a subject and cares for us as well. Thank you. My personal theory, is it okay? Can you guys hear me? My personal theory is that, this is a joke, but is that Plato was like an alien sent by the UFOs to start Western civilization in motion, something like that. Because he really was so outside the scope of the thinking of the times that it's just very hard to believe what he did. Naturally, he had no clue about modern physics or anything like that, obviously not. This was 2,400 years ago, right? But that's what makes it more remarkable. Right, it is really what pushes him is the intuition that the easiest thing for us to do is to fool ourselves, especially when it comes to grasping reality. That we're specialists, right, in making a fool of ourselves when it comes to the world that we can see. And really, I mean, obviously, our limited understanding of reality allows us to navigate the world fine, you know? So there's no evolutionary advantage to know about atoms, for example. All you need to do is just go around and you're not gonna, break your bones, and that's it. But anyways, I think what motivated him was this idea of really how to be fully human. Is that here's one of the questions, how can you be actually fully human? And so for him, it's the only way is to develop knowledge. Because what characterizes human beings is precisely this ability to see the hidden world. And if you never develop your knowledge, then you'll remain at the level of the lower species. My cat is super smart, but my cat will never be able to, of course, have any understanding, any glimpse, or anything like that about this world of presence that Plato understands. So it's really is there for human beings. And if you don't develop this knowledge, then you don't attain your humanity. You're right. I mean, with Augustine, that would be a separate full-fledged lecture. Well, I meant to really say that Christians today are very Platonic in more than one way. And I think that somebody has to pay tribute to this guy because a lot of ideas from modern Christianity can't really come from Plato. Do we have a minute? I can give an example in case you want me to. Or we can skip it. So, for instance, if you in the biblical tradition, if you really read it, that would be St. Paul the Apostle, as in Minneapolis and St. Paul. So, especially the letter to the Corinthians, is very clear that
the soul dies, and the body is the immortal part. So the body dies, but just for the time being. And then at the day of judgment and reckoning, the body comes back to life and goes on living forever. Right? And so in the biblical tradition, the mortal is the soul, really, and the immortal is the body. And then Augustine said, but this is not going to help us expand, because people will wonder, you know, what about somebody who gets burned, for example? In what sense this person is going to be born again? If somebody's devoured by a beast, you know, in what sense that body can be resurrected? And so what Augustine says is, well, we have to really take another gift from Plato and revert the order. And so Augustine makes it that the body is the mortal part. This is a Platonic idea, and the soul is the mortal part. And then eventually it trickles down into our imagination that that's the way it is, that the body is immortal and the soul is immortal. That's another gift from Plato to Christians.
Can everyone hear me through my mask?
Okay. Thank you very much. So I'm thinking a bit about the intersection between culture and biology and psychology. Mm-hmm. So kind of bringing it down from this universal scale here. But so we're born with a certain potential to perceive certain things, but our culture actually then limits for us what we do perceive. And I was wondering if you could talk about that a little.
Sure.
I don't know if you're familiar with that study of the Himba.
Sure.
And their perception of blue and green. Or the way that our language limits our perception of visible reality.
Yeah, I mean, with color, for example, there was a study with Russians and Americans, and they were given a palette of colors, and they were asked to count them. And it turns out that the Russians counted more colors, and the Americans counted fewer colors. And the explanation, in brief, is that in Russia, there are more words, particularly in the blue and green scale, for colors. And so having more labels makes it a little more easy for them to identify, aha, this is blibbity blab. But Americans don't have that blibbity blab word. So Americans oftentimes miss it. Naturally, if Americans kind of concentrate hard, you know, they can look at that particular shade of color. But the spontaneous perception, they tend to miss it. And so you're right in the sense that, in this case, language, for example, inhibits us from experiencing reality in a certain way. And I think that the person that comes to mind is our good buddy, Emil Durkheim. By the way, this is just for the sociologist. is one of the founding fathers of sociology. And this guy has the idea that the really limit of reality is essentially society, essentially. That society gives us an understanding of reality. And so our understanding of reality, in that sense of reality, is precisely limited by what our culture, our society, understands by it. And so for him, the way to try to see reality really for what it is to try to see beyond the limits of our society.
Thank you so much.